A podcast of the cinema.
Now, look at my levels.
Your levels are good.
I'm on the weird mic. I'm on the bad mic.
You're on, yes. You're on the, when we have a guest, one of us takes that mic.
I'm on the crap mic.
You could get a little closer, maybe.
Really?
Yeah, but you're good. You're in that.
So I should really almost be eating it.
Pretty much, yeah.
Okay.
That's the thing.
You know I like eating.
Yes, put that donut down, eat the mic instead.
Donuts down.
I know. All right. You are Dave White of sometimes of therap.com and always of Linoleum Knife. I'm Alonzo Duraldi, film reviews editor of The Rap.
I like that I'm always of Linoleum Knife.
You are. You are always Linoleum Knife. I'm also a film critic and TV recapper at What the Flick on the Young Turks Network on YouTube. And we're talking about donuts and crappy mics because we have a guest today. We're very excited to have with us one of the current screen legends of international cinema. She is the star of the legendary New Zealand film Once Were Warriors, which has recently been reissued on Blu-ray in the United States.
Just like last week.
By Film Movement, and has continued to have a distinguished career since then. Most recently, tangling with Vin Diesel in The Last Witch Hunter, and she is about to head off to Canada to do a pilot for Freeform, so we're psyched to get her into the house because we always like having her in the house, and now she's on the podcast too, so it's exciting. Everybody welcome Rena Owen.
Kia ora koutou. I kind of have to say the perfunctory New Zealand greeting, kia ora koutou, seeing we actually talking about what's become a cult classic.
Oh, absolutely. Well, yeah. I mean, not even, I mean, I think cult is putting too fine a point on it. It's a pretty mainstream classic. I remember when it came out, it was the movie that outgrossed Jurassic Park in New Zealand the year
that's
that Jurassic
right.
Park
that's
came
right.
out.
Like,
that was the selling
that's
point.
That's right. That was one of the biggest taglines for that year. It did. It smashed the New Zealand box office because it opened the day it premiered in Cannes. It opened in New Zealand that same day. And it just went off. It went off the charts. It's still actually in the top five films of the best box office earners in New Zealand. And in 20 years later, 2014, it got voted as the number one best film of New Zealand of all time.
Nice.
I approve of that.
Absolutely, yeah.
That's a pretty huge accolade.
Totally,
because
yeah.
We've had a lot of hits since then, like
yeah.
Whale Rider,
sure.
Boy.
Yeah.
Of course, Jane Campion's Piano.
Of course, and Sweetie and all that.
Sweetie
stuff, yeah.
And, gosh.
No, Angel at My Table.
Angel at My Table. Peter Jackson's franchises, humongous franchises. But they're not considered New Zealand films, rightfully so, because they're ultimately English stories financed by
Hollywood, yeah.
Yeah. Mostly Hollywood.
Now, had
so what you're really saying is nobody can beat you personally.
Oh no, I'd never say that. Yeah. I'd never say that.
So if you were to like leg wrestle Jane Campion,
see, because
you would cream.
I think of you as the president of New Zealand. When your name comes up, I think, oh yes, the president of New Zealand. She's my friend, by the way. So, you're the only famous person I know from New Zealand. So, I just think of you as sort of the queen of that land.
Oh, let me tell you, I took Rena to CineFamily when the guys from The Worst Idea of All Time taped their season one
That's
finale
right.
episode.
Uh-huh.
And I had never seen how other New Zealanders respond to being in the presence of the president of New Zealand. And they did everything but genuflect. It was very exciting to take in. Tim and Guy were like, oh my God, you brought the president of New Zealand.
It kind of, you know, that's the thing about this film, not just in New Zealand, it raised the bar. And independent filmmaking, and a lot of people around the world at various film festivals said the same thing, how it kind of helped to change and define independent cinema at the time.
Sure.
Yeah. It really was a trailblazing film.
Well, we were looking at it again this morning before you came over, and I said to Alonzo, this is, on the world stage at that moment, this is on the same sort of level with, stylistically, the aesthetic of a film like Trainspotting, in that you've got a film that's really homegrown from where it comes from. And it's about people who aren't often the subject of films.
Yeah.
And so the, and it's just the look of it, very modern look and a very aggressive, you know, filmmaking style and just inventive camera work and really raw performances. Yeah. And it's just an amazing movie.
There's kind of this international subgenre of like, isn't life terrible for poor people? You know, like you've got like Luis Buñuel's Los Olvidados and Salaam Bombay, and sort of every country kind of has their version of
that's
that
right,
one.
That's
but
right.
There's something that's so kind of raw and immediate about this one. Had there not really been, like, is part of the reason it was such a huge deal in New Zealand at the time because there had not really been a lot of sort of Maori stories on the big screen at that point?
I think it was more to do with the with the issues that the film explores. And in fact, that's why it translated and did so well around the world, because the themes are universal.
They are.
You know, what makes it unique is the fact that this is a Maori family. And for those listeners who are not too sure what a Maori is, Maldives, which is my father, are the indigenous, the natives of New Zealand, and then my mum was English European. So one year it was a Maori film, and it was the first of its kind, and suddenly all these little Maori kids and your Maori audience all could see themselves on the screen. And interesting, I'm just going to backtrack a bit, because it's one of the reasons I couldn't be an actor when I left high school, is because I had no role models.
Mm.
We had no brown faces on in our cinema or on our TV screen. So 15 years later, that's the thing that pleased me most about its success, is it did tell these little brown kids everywhere that they could be filmmakers. But it was mostly more, I think, to do with the issues of cultural alienation, alcohol abuse, domestic violence, sexual abuse, and that's the reason I knew it would do well internationally, because these things happen all around the world.
Right.
You know, uncle bullies come in three-piece suits.
Yeah.
Some of them come in priest costumes. You know, so this kind of this dysfunctional behavior happens all around the world.
And I totally forgot, until watching it this morning, that that's Cliff Curtis.
That is the brilliant Cliff Curtis, who will forever be known as Uncle Bully in New Zealand. It's just one of those things he can never live down, and I can never live down Beth, you know, and Temuera will never live down Jake. And people always ask me, they say, does that brass you off? And I said, well, on one hand, yeah, you get a bit tired of it, but on the other hand, it's a privilege to have a hit.
Sure.
It's a privilege to be in a movie
to be known for something.
Exactly, that people to this day, they never forget where and when they saw this film, because it just kicks you in the gut.
Yeah. It's and more than that, more than the fact that it was a hit, it's a movie that matters.
Yeah.
And it's a movie that's really tied to its decade. So when people talk about the 90s, they'll say, "Oh yeah, in independent cinema, this was one of those important films of that time."
Yeah.
And so, and if you're an actor, honestly, the fact that an actor gets to work in anything is a miracle. And if you're an actor that gets to be in a film that lives a long time, that's wild.
It blows me away, because to this day I consistently get new fans, and these are young people, the millennials. They're watching this movie.
Wow.
You know, it hasn't dated.
No, not at all.
Except for the high-waisted jeans.
Well,
I look at that and I go, we thought that was a good look back then.
At least they weren't acid wash.
Exactly.
They'll come back around.
But I read this film was based on a book, and I'm not a book reader, because I have a little bit of AD, so it's very hard for me to focus for too long on any one thing.
Right.
Which is the great gift of acting, because you're forced to just go shunk, you know, like a laser. But I read that book. I read it in 2 days. Wow. It was that gripping. Mm-hmm. And that book made me angry. It made me cry. It made me blah, blah, blah. And I, at the end of that book, I thought, if this book is ever made into a film, it would be an amazing film, and that would be a role to die for.
Mm.
And then 3 years later, they made it. I auditioned for it like everybody else in New Zealand auditioned for the role, and I was over the moon to be cast in this role. But I knew when we were making it, I intuitively knew that it had the potential to be very important and very successful, because it did dare to deal with these social issues that happen all around the world. Mm-hmm. And I was very familiar with Lee Tamahori's style from all of his commercials, because mm-hmm. he was a brilliant commercial maker, and I knew he would stylize it, mm-hmm. and I knew he would make it trendy and hip, and so all of those things combined, people could then maybe stomach a little bit of the sexual abuse or whatever was going on.
23 years later, it still looks very cool.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a gut punch, but you're right. It's still very watchable at the same time.
Stu Dreisberg, he was a big part of the look, because, of course, he's gone on to have multiple Oscar nominations. Right. Brilliant cinematographer, and he did camera, and he was the cinematographer on the film.
Right.
Very low budget, $1.2 million American dollars.
Mm-hmm.
And this film, made on a bunch of natives on a small budget in 34 days, became Time Magazine's number 6 on the top 10 list of the best films made in the world.
Wow.
In 1994.
Nice.
But guess what else was on that list at number 4? Heavenly Creatures. And to this day, and it was a stunning year for New Zealand cinema.
It was the same year, wasn't it?
Yeah. Stunning year for New Zealand cinema. And we had 2 short films in the Cannes competition. And to this day, it's still my favorite Peter Jackson film is Heavenly Creatures.
Mine too. Oh, yeah. Totally, yeah. Although I think that opened in the States in 94, and I think Once Were Warriors didn't get here till 95.
You're right.
I remember seeing it. Yeah. I was in Dallas by that point. Yeah. I'd already moved.
Yeah.
Now, so, you know, you mentioning the cinematographer and obviously Lee Tamahori and your co-stars, you all sort of relocated to L.A. on the success of this film. How has the industry here treated you? And do you still work a lot back in New Zealand? I know you do TV there periodically and other stuff.
Yeah, I didn't relocate straight away. I actually went back to theater. I was quite intimidated by the whole idea of Hollywood because I'd come out of theater. And it's a very different ball game compared to being in the public eye and being in front of a camera. Excuse me. Because Once Were Warriors, I mean, before this, I had done 9 years of theater, predominantly theater and a bit of television. And I did my first feature film. So my first film I got cast in, and so did Cliff Curtis, was the Kevin Costner, Kevin Reynolds film Rapa Nui.
Oh, right. Yes.
Which shot in Easter Island.
Mm-hmm.
And so we all went over there on 2-month contracts. 6 months later, we were still there. People were like, we need our actors back, you know. So they waited for us to get off the island to shoot Once Were Warriors. But Cliff pretty much came straight to America. And so did Tim Yeda. He took his first Hollywood offers. It did come because of theater. I was a little bit more fussy in terms of scripts.
Hmm.
The first 2 scripts I was offered, I intuitively knew the first one would flop. And it did. It was a similar sense of snow, and it nearly killed Julia Ormond's career.
Oh, yeah.
And I just knew. I thought it's not a... I no matter how long I've been in this game, I will always believe you're only as good as your script.
Well, sure.
Any of us are only as good as our scripts. And then the next film I got offered, again, I thought, no, this isn't the kind of project I want to be in, was the Cindy Crawford film.
Oh.
You remind me what it was.
Oh,
yeah.
God, with one of the Baldwins.
Yeah,
yes.
That's it.
That
film is legendary.
You can understand why I was kind of turning down these things, because my agent was kind of starting to get a bit annoyed, because he's like, come on, these are offers. Because I was with ICM at the time, and it was like, you know, big offers in the 90s, big money. Would I take those roles now? Hell yeah. I would. I'd bank that money. But here's what was more important. Here's what was more important to me at that time, and I do believe this. Your second film is more important than your first.
Mm.
It was really important for me to secure my artistic integrity.
Okay.
You know, and I did. I waited. I waited for a film that I thought, okay, this is going to be a movie that's really cool. And at one point, I did think I'd made the wrong choice because I saw Cliff working here. I saw Tim Yedda working here. I saw Lita Mahori working here. I waited for a film that was by Rolf De Heer, Dance Me to My Song.
Okay.
And that ended up in competition in Cannes. I think it was 98. And, you know, one of the biggest critics there at the time, he said, Reno, you know, when you pop up, it's in something special. Hmm. And I thought, yeah, I'm glad I waited for something, because I was more relieved when Tim would be the first one to say this. His first three Hollywood movies are all on the top 10 list of the worst films made in America. He is. He brags about it now. It's a new medal. He's king of the raspberries. It was Barbed Wire. Oh, it right. was Speed 2. And it was Island of Dr. Moreau. he said to me, sis, I made a lot of money, but that money's gone. But my reputation with the raspberry, it's still there and it'll be there for life. Same thing happened to Lita Mahori.
Well, yes,
His first Hollywood movie was a bomb. Mulholland Drive or whatever.
Mulholland Falls.
Thank you.
Right,
Yeah. And Cliff, the greatest thing about Cliff is he came at a time. He looked like Osama bin Laden. And he did. If you look at his side profile and his nose, he looked Middle Eastern. So that's how he got in. Three Kings. He played Middle Eastern, and for those first 5 years, because he's such a good actor, he continued to play Middle Eastern, and then eventually Mexican.
I was about to say, he plays Mexican quite often, too.
Yeah. Whereas me and Tim Yedda, we couldn't pass as that. So back to your original question of how it treated me or treated us when we first came here, I was in a kind of uncastable place. Hmm. And I would go in, and they'd say to my agent, she's great, but what is she? Well, because back in the 90s, it was still really boxed.
Right.
You still hadn't had your first Latina breakthrough.
Right.
You know, that happened with J-Lo.
Mm-hmm.
You still hadn't had your first Asian. That happened with Lucy Liu and, it was a famous...
Charlie's Angels?
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you. Film master of a film. So for someone like me who didn't really look right or look like any one thing you could label.
Right.
But eventually the right film did come, and unfortunately I was on a TV contract in Australia and they wouldn't let me go. And that's just the way it is. And that film was Alien, Sigourney Weaver's Alien. The only consolation is it bombed. It was the one that was made by the French director in the late 90s.
Oh, Alien Resurrection. Yeah.
Yes, Alien Resurrection. There was a role in that and that was an offer.
Oh, wow.
But I couldn't get out of my TV. Yeah, get out of my TV contract.
Now, you did, however, wind up in Star Wars Episode II opposite Tamara
That's
Morrison.
Right.
Was that an intentional, like, was somebody in there a fan of What's for Warriors?
Mr. George Lucas.
Ah.
Yeah, he's a huge fan of that movie. He loved that movie. He said to his casting director, who was Robin Gerland, he said, I want those two leads.
Nice.
And, you know, he's still a real artist at the core of who he is. Mm-hmm. He's still a real indie kind of guy.
Mm.
And I think he always will be. So initially when they were talking to my agent about casting me, it was for the role of Captain Typho. And I was so excited. You know, where the security guy for Padme wears an eye patch. And I thought, wow, what a phenomenal, cool, kick-ass role.
Like lesbians didn't love you enough already.
I'm going to get more love. And then halfway through negotiations, I got the call saying, look, sorry, George just looked at the balance of the movie and has decided that it's too many women in all of these scenes. You know, it's woman
I'm
heavy.
Sorry. What?
Yeah.
Too many...
No, he was right.
What?
He was right. Well, when you watch the film, because the room's full of women, you needed that guy, that one security guy, because this is Padme. This is your, I mean, you could have, because she had other women around him.
Yeah.
But back in those days, you still needed the guy. You needed the guy. You needed some testosterone in there, in the mix. And I understood that once I saw the film, but they said, but there's an alien. He still really wants you in the movie. There's an alien. Would you consider being an alien? I'm like, yeah, okay, whatever. Because here's the great thing about that. I wasn't a Star Wars fan.
Oh, funny.
So, no, it was just another gig to me, and it was fun. Mm-hmm. And And I think George really liked that about me and Tim, is we just treated him like George. He was just George, another filmmaker, because we didn't come with all the
baggage.
Yeah. And I didn't find out about it, to be quite honest with you. I went there. I had a great job. I was like a big kid on set. George was, contrary to popular belief, he's a very fine director. He's very, very specific with his notes. He knows exactly what he wants. And because with my character, Ton Wee, as you all know, I got CGI'd. So he showed me and Ewan McGregor all the storyboards and said, okay, guys, this is what you're going to be walking down. This is what you're looking at. He showed me a big cardboard cutout they'd made of Ton Wee. And then we kept having this problem because Ewan, as all actors do, he kept looking at my eyes. And George said, Ewan, you got to remember, by the time we've done a CGI job on her, she's going to be like this tall.
She's going to be 9 feet tall.
Yeah, 9 feet tall. Aussie crew guy. Ingenuity of Aussie and New Zealand crews, because they have no money. They come up with all this ingenuity. Came up with this idea. We cut off the cardboard head, the cutout. We cut the head off of Ton Wee at the base of the neck, and he taped it to a blue construction helmet. Precisely to give Ewan McGregor
an
the exact precise eyeline. And then if you watch behind the scenes of episode two, you'll see me. I continually walk into the lights because I forget I have this big head on top of my head.
And were you wearing like a green onesie?
I was just in my sweats.
Oh, okay.
So it was totally green screen, blue screen, I think. I can't remember exactly what color, but every time I did a scene, then they would do the silver ball thing.
I see.
Whatever process that they do the silver ball thing. And then we did the scene with Temuera, who of course plays Jango Fett, and young Daniel Logan, and some of the Aussie crew guys joked, Jake and Beth end up in Star Wars.
Sequel no one saw coming.
Exactly, exactly. Outer space and domestic violence. But I tell you, it still did not hit me until 2 years later. I was here in LA and I got invited to the premiere. And, you know, I went here at the Chinese Man, and all these people were lined up, and there was all this chaos, really, premiere chaos, in a good way. And I watched the film, and at the end of the film, I said to my American friend, I said, this is a bit of a big deal, isn't it? And he looked at me, he said, yeah, it's one of the biggest film franchises in the world, hello. But it still didn't hit me until I went to my first convention in Dallas, Texas. And I saw all of these people lined up in costume, and that's when I went, oh my God, this is a religion.
You had an action figure. Did that not hit you then?
No.
You personally are a source of annual fascination in our home at Christmas, because you handmade us a little paper doll Christmas ornament of Ton Wee with your face,
a reverse of what the set was,
glued onto the top of the neck, and it's on our Christmas tree every year.
I'm so right.
And it's like 2 years ago, 3 years, whenever it was. You came to the Christmas party. You couldn't stay long. You were gone after like an hour, 90 minutes. Not 15 minutes after you left, a friend of ours came in, looked at the tree. Your ornament is like front and center. And they were like, what's that? That's Star Wars. Who's that woman with the face? Whose face is that? And I was like, that's the actress who was that character in Star Wars. And they were like, where'd you get that? I was like, she made it for us. She's a friend of ours. She left the party 15 minutes ago. He's like, she was here? Like, people are so freaked out about everything related to Star Wars that the idea that someone who was in a Star Wars movie was in our home, it makes them crazy. Like, and it happens with a fair amount of regularity at the Christmas party. Someone will point at that ornament and say, what's the story? And then either, wait a second, she just left, where do I get her? Or is she here right now? Like, and they have to want to go find you. And
And you have been very sweet about talking to people who are talking your ear off about this stuff.
Yeah.
At our parties, I've witnessed it happen.
Do you know? It's all part of the privilege and the pleasure, and that's how I started to learn about the whole world of Star Wars was through fans at conventions, and a lot of these fans are incredibly intelligent and really, really interesting people. Yeah, once in a while you might get a weirdo. Well, like there was—I'll never forget the one.
All our friends are weirdos. So
We're good weirdos. We're good weirdos. We're good nerds. We're good nerds. No, there was only one time I think I was at a convention in New York, and this fan came up, and he was a little dodgy looking, and he kind of said to me, he said, "I hope you don't think badly of me, but it's your character. It's the first time I've wanted sex, to have sex with a man."
There's a come online.
I know, and I said, you know what? I said, I take that as a compliment. Because the thing that really surprised me was how much of myself I could still see in that CGI'd character. Mm-hmm. That walk is a very distinctive Owen walk in my family. Oh. And she was very sensual. Mm-hmm. And in fact, George modified the look of her because the first image of her, she was very androgynous. She was probably male, looked more male than female. But he feminized her. He gave her a little headband, gave her earrings. And because of that female sensuality,
right?
You know, you could still feel that and see that. And to this day, that's why films like Star Wars still need actors.
Right.
Because it can't generate the energy or the spirit or the sensual or the sexuality of us.
Right. There's a core of acting that even in, if you're, you know, being motion captured or whatever, it's still coming out of the... Interesting.
I'll tell you one quick thing, sorry, Alonso, before we move on, because it still didn't really hit me at the time, but straight after doing Star Wars Episode 2 in Sydney, Australia, they shot it on Fox's lot, I came straight back here to do a bit part in Steven Spielberg's AI.
Right, yes.
And I did not know this, but it's just recently changed. For many years, I was one of only 5 actors in the entire world to have worked with both George Lucas and Steven Spielberg.
Wow.
It's now 6. Yeah.
Oh, Adam Driver.
Yeah.
I did not know that.
Yeah, me neither. Nice. It was a Star Wars fan pointed that out to me. He said, "Do you realize you're one of 5 actors in the entire..." I'm like, "No, I had no idea. I didn't have a clue about that."
You guys should have club meetings.
Yeah, we should.
Okay, so tell me about the new TV show.
Oh, this is very, very exciting. I'm just absolutely over the moon, thrilled. Firstly, I should say Freeform is a cable, the new cable.
It's ABC Family.
ABC Family used to be called ABC Family.
That's right, yeah. And part of the Disney world. And they wanted a platform where they could do edgier stuff. Mm. You know, they want their own Netflix. They want their own Amazon.
That's their pregnant teen channel.
Exactly. And so they wanted a channel where they could do stuff that's a little edgy, a little dark, perhaps. And this comes in their drama category because it's absolutely a drama. It's set in a coastal town, Bristol Cove. And the legend of this particular coastal town is that once upon a time, mermaids inhabited this cove. Mm. So the whole town, there's a lot of mermaid memorabilia. They have a mermaid parade. Mm. Tourists come to Bristol Cove to go to the beach, hang out. It's a bit like, say, going to Santa Barbara or going to Ventura.
Right, but it's their sort of local gimmick.
Their gimmick is the mermaids.
I'm from Roswell, New Mexico, so I know all
you
about
You know exactly.
This.
It's good. Well, this one's mermaids. And my character owns the Curious Shop, you know, the shop with all the paraphernalia and tourist items.
Souvenirs,
thank you. And the one thing we do find out about her in the pilot is that she has an enormous amount of knowledge about mermaids. Mm. Because there's the two schools. Some people believe it was just, think it was just a myth, and there's another school that believes it was real. Mm. So I don't think I can give too much away.
Okay.
But it's exciting.
What's the name of it again?
Oh, of course I should tell you the name, The Deep.
But
I think they may end up changing that.
They
because
might change
there's
the name.
Too old when you
say,
look it up.
The Nick Nolte, Jacqueline Bisset movie.
That's right. Yeah. So I think at the moment it's a working title, but they're good characters. It's what I liked about it is it's got the typical formula, but there's a reason people use that formula. It's because it works.
Sure, yeah.
It works. But it's a bit Twin Peakish with a little bit of True Blood. Mm. It's just really, really interesting. I think it has enormous potential to do very, very well.
Now,
so.
On a show like this, is there expectation that you're going to do like an American accent? Or is the fact that you bring a sort of, and I hate the word exotic, but that you're, you know, you bring in a sense of difference totally work for a show
well,
like this?
Well, this is what I'm really excited to be doing this week. And it's why they're taking me up early because the key, because we don't actually start shooting to the 30th, but this pre-production period, mm-hmm. as they've already kind of notified me about, the writer, the showrunner, the director, the producers want to kind of talk about the character.
Oh, cool.
You know, so it's a collaborative. Yeah, I went and I did a generic, you know, just a very generic transatlantic, which is kind of, you know, one of those voices that, a bit like Tan, we welcome Master Jedi. You know, so it's just very non-locatable.
Sort of flat.
Yeah, just kind of flat. So they may want me to sound a bit more British, maybe. Who knows? But
from the way you're describing the character, it sounds like even in a town of, you know, Americans, the person with the souvenir shop who like has all the insider knowledge about mermaids could totally be from somewhere
that's
else
right.
and be, you know,
that's,
different.
That's
from...
exactly right. And they obviously felt like that because I didn't find out till after I'd signed the contract, but they were like, we knew you were the right person before you even came in for the audition.
Oh, well, that's always good.
So, exactly. Because it also gave me a sense, an idea of how what their vision's like in
sure.
terms of what they want with their characters.
All right.
You know, so she's an interesting character. She's an enigma.
Ooh.
She's an enigma. It's a really cool character. And I'd love to tell you more, but you're going to have to watch the pilot.
When this thing starts airing, you'll have to come to our TV podcast and then tell us about how you can't tell us what's happening on the show because it's all a mystery.
Oh, I think the ending, when I got to the end of the script, I went, oh my God, wow. Wow.
Fun.
Yeah.
All right.
That's great. Well, Raina, we can't wait to see the show, and we thank you for coming in and giving us some time on your way to Canada to go shoot the thing. So,
absolute pleasure.
Safe travels, break a leg, and congrats on the Sponsor Warriors Blu-ray. I hope there are that it means checks with your name on them.
Yes,
in an avalanche.
Yeah, no, we never. You know, back in those days, those kind of contracts were never locked down for New Zealand films. It's the kudos that comes with it, and it brings new fans, and you got a piece of work that's still relevant.
If you guys haven't seen this movie, catch up on it.
Yeah,
you should watch it.
It as you said, apart from the jeans, it has not aged a second.
I think the jeans look real cool,
and it really packs a punch. And your performance, especially, is
thank you.
Just something to behold. It's so vital and present and I got chills again watching it today. Just because I've known you for like. What, 15 plus years?
Yeah,
now?
Yeah.
Where did y'all meet?
I'm going to tell you a very, very quick story how Alonzo and I met.
You came to Dallas.
That was 1999. I was invited to be on the jury of the USA Film Festival by Mr. Alonzo. And I said, of course, I'd love to. I love doing film festivals. It's a wonderful way to watch a lot of product and to meet a lot of great filmmakers. And so that's where we first met.
Yeah.
Was in Dallas, Texas. And that's where I distinctively remember, I can't remember the name of the restaurant, but we all went to eat. It was like a diner after it all wrapped up after the awards.
Lucky's or something.
Yeah, because I got the photos. Yeah, yeah. I sent you the photos from that dinner. And then I never forget you saying that you guys were thinking about moving to LA. And I gave you my info and I said, please get in touch when you do. And it actually wasn't long after that. It was 2000?
Yeah, 99 was my last festival, actually. That summer we moved out here.
You moved out here and we've been in touch ever since. And I love coming to your guys' annual... oh, gosh, you do so many gatherings every year. But the main, your Thanksgiving, your Christmas...
Right.
Your what's the pumpkin pie one? Now, when do we do pumpkin pie?
Well, that's Thanksgiving.
That's Thanksgiving.
That's Thanksgiving.
And you used to do pumpkin pancakes at Christmas.
But there was one earlier in the year. What's that one? Was that no?
We've had some 4th of July parties.
4th of July, thank you.
You've been here a lot.
Oh, but when I'm in, yeah, when I'm in town,
a lot of events.
But, yeah. No, but the thing is, like, I've known you for so long, and I hadn't really gone back and looked at the film again until watching. It's like, oh yeah, she's amazing. Like, I forgot, you know. Like, I always knew, oh yeah, she did this movie, she was so great. But then watching it, I was like, oh crap, like, this person I know is giving me chills again.
Well, it's a thing where you just stop thinking about that after a while.
That's
you
right.
just think, well, this is our friend Rinna.
That's right.
And you don't think about anything else.
Yeah. No, that's
and
right.
And then you go back and you look at the thing again, and you think, oh, wait, yeah, I forgot. She's completely, totally amazing.
I'm going to tell people out there, if you've never seen this film, put your seatbelt on. It's in your face. It's a very in-your-face film, but it's well worth watching. And I think probably a little bit easier to stomach in this day and age, actually, 23 years later.
I mean, you know, I think
it's still hard to watch.
It's still hard, but I mean, I think we've seen more movies that have that have gone there.
Exactly. And guys, you get your payoff at the end, so hang in there.
Yes,
The thing about it is that, more films with this sort of rough content have come along, but it all comes down to whether the film is good or bad. Because a film about a dysfunctional family headed by an alcoholic can either leave me cold or move me deeply. Because I come from the same kind of family, same kind of alcoholism, the same kind of dysfunction. And this is something we've talked about on the show many times, so it's not like this big revelation. But, you know, this film moves me and makes me feel connected to it. Here I just hit the mic. Hooray.
That's how connected you feel.
I feel connected to it. And you know, others that are not well made at all, I just think, whatever, who cares? Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's powerful. The issue is important, but it's powerful because of how well made it is.
You know, and that happened around the world. I mean, the amount of people I saw walk out of the cinema just in tears.
Yeah.
All cultures. White, Asian. There was one screening I'll never forget when Uncle Bully's getting beaten up. There's this little Asian woman and she's up in the aisle and she's jumping up and down. I remember another screening, the guy is literally standing and he's yelling at the screen. I mean, it's that kind of movie.
Yeah, I know.
Because like you say, you know, all of us, there's something in it that we can all identify with to one degree or another. Because it's essentially a film about family and we all come from families.
Yeah.
Kia ora.
There you go. All right, we're going to leave it there.
Thank you for being our guest on the show.
My pleasure.
We adore you.
Adore you back. Love you back.
Come see us when you're back from Canada.
We'll do.
Okay.
We have erased Rinna Owen from the building. Welcome to part two.
Yes.
Of Linoleum Knife. She had a lunch to go to.
Yes. She's a delight, but she couldn't stick around.
We booted her out of the house. I love her so much.
She fled screaming. No, she's great. She's awesome.
What I like in Friends is people who are fun to be around.
Mm.
I mean, I'm not counting an interview scenario where you're sort of asking them questions and they're telling you things. Just hanging out with someone.
Yeah.
She's great just to hang out with.
Always.
And that's...
she's good lunch company.
That's why. Yeah, that's why I like having her around. So we have movies to talk about.
We do. Where should we start?
Why don't you spend 60 seconds talking about Snowden?
Snowden, yes. Well,
I didn't see it, and I'm probably not going to see it.
Yeah, it's kind of a letdown. You know, not to make the obvious joke about Joseph Gordon-Levitt, but again, in the way that when The Walk came out, it was like, well, it's, you know, it's okay, but you should really just see Man on Wire. That movie at least had the excuse of, well, yeah, but Man on Wire never sent the camera out on the wire, and, you know, now we can fake it. This movie doesn't do anything that Citizen 4 didn't already do and better. So it's basically, you know, it's Oliver Stone explaining Edward Snowden to you. And if, you know, if you never watch documentaries and you need to have some attractive movie stars explain current events to you, then I guess it does that. But it's not nearly as tense or exciting as Citizen 4 was. And so it just becomes this kind of explanatory thing of like, He doesn't get into special forces because he messed up his leg, and then he joins the CIA, and he knows about computers, and he finds out about the stuff that the CIA is doing, and isn't this terrible? And then he finally decides to expose it, and then he meets with Laura Poitras in a hotel room in Hong Kong, and, right. And it's like, it just, none of it pops. None of it has that Oliver Stone sizzle that you remember from, like, his best films, like, you know, something like JFK, or even from Platoon, which is not a showy film, but by all means, but it's a very powerful one. This one just kind of limps along, and, you know, it's just not nearly as interesting as it should be, given how vital its message is and how important what it has to say is. It just doesn't say it very well. You know, I think you should leave this movie feeling ginned up about the fact that the government is monitoring your emails and your phone calls and all this stuff as a matter of course, and it doesn't really even generate a healthy head of outrage. I do like Ben Schnetzer in it. I always like Ben Schnetzer. He's a young actor, I think, you know, like, takes these nothing parts and really turns them into something. And he's the one person in this movie that doesn't kind of feel like, you know, walking exposition guy.
You just interviewed our friend Matt Seitz.
Yes.
About his new Oliver Stone book.
Yes.
The name of the book is what?
The Oliver Stone Experience.
And
it's the Oliver Stone Experience.
You, no human being. Very. Let me say that differently. I'm going to say 5 human beings listening to this show know the melody of what you were just doing.
You made a reference to Linda Evangelista being a jeweler episodes ago. The song that I was riffing on was, there was a Linda Barry, the cartoonist and author. Was it like a stage show she did, or was it a radio thing?
It was a CD.
There was a CD called The Linda Barry Experience.
She's on my Fantasy Dancing with the Stars team.
Okay, well, I get Sandra.
All right.
But this week on LKTV, we floated the idea of rotisserie dancing with the stars, where you get to create your own teams of celebrity. Dave has already insisted that he gets Joan Didion, so, you know.
And Bellatar and Linda Barry.
Fine.
Yeah. And so
I get Glenda Jackson, Barney Frank, and Sandra Bernhardt so far.
Would you like to know more about this? You should subscribe, become a member of our club.
And get LKTV.
It's $4 per month. Or more if you want objects and things and extra content. If you just want LKTV, go to
patreon.com/linoleumknife, all one word.
And you'll learn more about our Fantasy League Dancing with the stars teams.
Anyway, there was a CD called The Linda Barry Experience, and the opening song was her saying, "It's the Linda Barry Experience." So whenever I see Matt's book title, I just think, "It's the Oliver Stone Experience."
Now, neither you nor I are the world's biggest Oliver Stone fans.
I guess not. I mean, I like some of his films, obviously.
Right.
But I haven't been gaga over anything he's done in the last 20 years.
Kinda.
I mean, you know, I think maybe not since, I'd have to go back.
I took my mother to see World Trade Center.
Oh, I liked W. I did like W.
I liked W. Mm-hmm. I took my mom to see World Trade Center.
Uh-huh. Pre-stroke or post-stroke?
Post. It was 2006.
Oh, okay.
And her sort of incredibly emotional response to it sort of bled into me. Like, I was
colored. I felt your experience.
I felt sort of emotionally connected to it as well, and it really is a moving story. And at the same time, it didn't feel like an Oliver Stone movie to me. Didn't feel like the Oliver Stone film that I knew from the past.
It's not a movie about, you know, the jet fuel steel beams conspiracy. It's a rescue. I mean, yeah. Matt even described in the interview, it's a rescue movie.
Yeah. And so what is Matt's I'm searching for the word. What made him want to do this book? Because if I were going to pick it around, I mean, Matt has already published a book about Wes Anderson.
Two, actually.
Beautiful coffee table book.
There was the follow-up book,
and then the follow-up book about
Grand Budapest.
Grand Budapest. What's his Oliver Stone?
Well, because he wanted to do another book. He wanted to find another director who would sort of allow him to go this deep and talk to him this much and you know, dig into the archives and all.
Right.
And he had interviewed Stone like 4 times because Stone made, you have to remember, when Matt was in Dallas, when we were in the 90s.
JFK
and Talk Radio.
Right.
And Born on the 4th of July.
All Texas-based.
And parts of Any Given Sunday.
Mm-hmm.
So he had talked to him a bunch, and I think, and in fact, Matt says he was an extra in Born on the 4th of July.
Matt was an extra in Born on the 4th of July?
Yes.
What?
I remember this. I mean, I remember, because that was the period that I was at the USA Film Festival in various capacities, and like Oliver Stone was always in town making a movie. Like,
right.
Like, I saw Talk Radio right before I moved to Dallas, and then I remember we honored, the festival gave him the Great Director Award while he was shooting JFK. Like, he literally showed up at the theater with a full body sunburn because he'd been shooting the Dealey Plaza segment all day. and he came back for Born on the 4th of July, and I remember like the year that Dennis Quaid came to the festival, we had to like work out some weekend that he wasn't going to be there doing Any Given Sunday. So yeah, I could totally see the connection where like Matt would have gotten to know this guy, you know, professionally, journalistically, you know, just over that period of him being in Dallas. And obviously he likes the movies, or a lot of them, and you know,
right.
He said actually that he gave Natural Born Killers a somewhat negative review at the time that it came out, and that Stone quoted the review at him at one point.
Ooh.
But he says he likes the movie more now. He says now that life has beaten the crap out of him a bit, that he appreciates it more. But yeah, I mean, Matt's a really great interviewer, and I think a fascinating critic, and so even if you aren't like the biggest Oliver Stone fan, I think that what Matt has to say about Oliver Stone, or what Matt gets Oliver Stone to talk about, is of interest. And it's a gorgeous book, and it's crammed with like just amazing photographs, not just stills from the film, but like all the, you know, like newspaper clippings of the things that the movies are about, and stuff from Stone's own personal life, and, you know, essays from people like Ramin Barani wrote the introduction. Jim Beaver writes a thing about being a Vietnam vet and what Platoon meant to him and that kind of thing. It's a great book. And he's actually got 2 books out right now. Like, Matt Seitz never sleeps, literally. He's also the co-author.
Oh, I know.
Yes, he's never slept in this apartment even.
Have I said this on the show before?
I think you have, yeah.
You go to bed. If he is your house guest, you go to bed. You say goodnight. He's working. You wake up in the morning very early, like at 5 a.m., which is about the time I wake up. He's asleep, but it's because he's sitting upright on the couch having fallen asleep while working.
Yeah.
And then he wakes up. And he starts working it. Like, I don't know when this man sleeps.
Yeah, you got me. But anyway, he's also the co-author of TV, the book that he wrote with Alan Sepinwall, that's also out right now. So there's a whole lot of Matt Seitz in your local bookstore. But Snowden, on the other hand, whatever.
Okay, so The Blair Witch.
Very blah.
From Adam Wingard.
Yes, and Simon Barrett.
And Simon Barrett. Who gave
who
us...
Who know better.
Well, okay. Tell people what it's about.
Well, Wingard and Barrett, just if you didn't already know.
We'll get to them in a second. Okay, tell the people what the movie's about.
Okay, it is ostensibly a sequel to 1999's influential The Blair Witch Project, but it is, I believe Bibbs called it a requel. it is a sequel that is also a remake. Which is just despicable on its face.
I like that, William Bibbiani.
So it's basically the same movie. There's a guy, and Heather was his older sister, and he thinks she might still be alive in the Brickettsville woods. So he gets his friends together, and one of them's making a documentary, and they hook up with these other people they know from the internet who posted some clip on YouTube, and they've got cameras, and they're all going into the woods. And then all the stuff that you know that's going to happen from the Blair Witch Project happens again. And they really don't bring a lot new to the table. It's just, let's do this again, but let's try and recapture the magic of a movie that did something really new and special that then spawned a million imitators and parodies and everything else, and try and pass that off as being fresh in 2016.
There is exactly one cool, gross scene in the movie,
mm-hmm.
and there is exactly one
frightening scene, but I guess
claustrophobic.
Claustrophobic more than anything. There's the someone gets an injured leg, and it's nasty to see the thing that happens. A supernatural thing happens to the leg. And then the final girl is stuck crawling through a really, really, really tight dirt tunnel under the house. And if you know what, if you've seen the Blair Witch Project, then you know what house I'm talking about. And that's it. It is
literally the same old, same old.
It is so tedious and so unsurprising. The sound design is meant to be the fear, because there's a lot of loud noises, so many loud noises that do not come with visual components. It's just a camera being thrown around while a loud noise is happening, and then people are shrieking.
It's like a Dave White horror movie, because they hit the mic alarm.
I only hit the mic about once an episode. But there's a lot of microphone hitting. The yelling and the running and the yelling and the running
and the crying and the running
and the crying and the screaming. At one point, I just remember thinking, young lady, would you refrain from shrieking at every second? Then maybe you might be able to hear your surroundings and escape your certain doom. But no.
It makes you appreciate Heather Donahue's performance.
Heather Donahue's performance is great.
Yes.
I will not listen to anyone who's got negative things to say about the Blair Witch Project.
I think
terrifying film.
It is. Yeah, it scared me twice.
Yeah.
I remember the first time I saw it was at Sundance, and I was and this was at the end. Like, I was there for the second half, and all week I've been hearing, "Oh, Blair Witch Project." So by the time I was able to get into a screening, it was that last weekend, and I was very much like arms folded. All right, what do you got? Let's see what you got. Scared the crap out of me.
Right.
And then I saw it again with you when it opened that summer, and scared the crap out of me again.
Yeah. Gave me some nightmares.
Yes.
Actual nightmares. We don't have to rehash this story, because it's a story that we've told on the show
okay,
before
fine.
About the night you came into the bedroom and stood in front of the closet a little too long with your back to me, and I woke up because you were making noises, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So,
anyway, this one, not scary.
I'm talking about even as far as the filmmaking goes, because in the Blair Witch Project, it was always understood that one of them was holding the camera.
Right. Well,
there was never an omniscient camera.
Right.
And in this film, it goes back and forth.
No.
Oh, yeah. No. There are moments. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
I did not. Here's the thing, though. There's four earpiece cameras.
Mm-hmm.
There's the handheld,
mm-hmm.
and then there's the other people's handheld.
Uh-huh.
And I think every shot is coming from one of those
sources. There are moments when the people on screen are on camera, and none of them are holding a camera.
Well, the earpiece cameras, no one's holding that camera. They're just...
No. I mean... Everyone in the frame.
Like, oh, everybody in the movie is in the movie.
And we can see everybody and who's looking at them.
And it's not the drone?
The drone is stuck in the tree, if
okay.
you recall.
Right. Well, yeah. At some point, yes. All right. I don't know. I'd have to go. I will never watch this movie again. I would have to go back and look at it.
And
see if
even
that's the
case. If I'm wrong, it still sucks.
Well, yeah, exactly. Yeah. Like, we're getting into the weeds when, like, the trees here are the issue. It's a dumb movie.
It was so annoying listen to this film and to watch this film.
So let's talk about Wingard and Barrett.
Nothing was happening of any value. There's not one surprise.
No.
I want these guys, and I assume they're going to get their chance. Because this movie has not made any money this weekend.
No.
I want these guys to keep giving us their own ideas.
They did You're Next.
I'm so unhappy.
They did The Guest.
With what Hollywood does to indie filmmakers, they are robbing cinema of new voices by taking the new voices and the strength of one or two cool movies that they make,
mm-hmm.
and then inserting them into the machine of corporate filmmaking and giving them a franchise to play with. But it's not their franchise to play with. They are just stuck into it.
Right. I mean, well, you know, and the thing is, I think there are cases where it works. For example, you have like Ryan Coogler
yes.
doing Fruitvale Station,
yes.
and then he pitched, hey, I want to bring Rocky back, but this way.
Right.
And do Creed. Like, that was cool. And that's like, yes, give him that opportunity. Give him the keys to that. But when...
And he somehow figured out a way to control the story.
Yes.
All right.
Because he also wrote it.
And I don't know these guys wrote it too.
Well, okay, well,
they wrote this movie.
I know, but let me get to that. But
and then, I don't
but,
know.
But then you have like then you have the safety not guaranteed guy
mm-hmm.
getting Jurassic World, and
right.
yeah, that's just this enormous thing that he's just plugged into and is like calling the shots, but not. But I mean, he's literally calling the shots, but not really in charge of the whole giant mechanism. And this is a case where it's not even like these guys got handed a giant franchise, because as you know, obviously, the brand is a big deal, but this is not an expensive movie.
No.
It probably didn't cost that much more than The Guest cost. It was like $5 million.
But it held the promise of rebooting a popular brand.
Sure. And that's
essentially the same situation.
The most interesting thing about this movie is that for a very long time, it was just known as The Woods.
Yes.
And it was like, oh, Wingard and Barrett are doing a found footage horror movie. Oh, okay, interesting. And then at Comic-Con, they unveiled it. Ha, 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 it's Blair Witch. Ooh, ah, exciting, great.
And here's why it was so exciting. Because we like these guys.
Yes, exactly.
We like what they do. And now I want them to go back and do the thing they do.
Yes, and not this.
And I'm glad that it's not going to be this part two, because this movie has made practically nothing.
No, weekend. I mean, this movie will probably break even because of how cheap it was.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's not going to... If they pull the plug on Ghostbusters, they're definitely pulling the plug on more Blair Witches.
They've got their... They obviously have ideas. I want them to make films of their own ideas.
Yeah, any hack could have made this movie. Because it's just a redo of Blair Witch Project.
I'm glad they got paid. I'm sure it was a nice amount of money.
Sure.
Not, you know, a crazy amount of money.
Yeah.
Not a Jurassic World amount of money. No. But probably more than they've been paid in the past.
Yeah.
And if that gives them the juice to go do something on their own, then good, I guess. But I need, me personally, as a horror fan, I need these guys in the world making cool, inventive horror films.
Right.
And
no,
not,
I agree.
And not
agree.
This.
Elsewhere so. In long-delayed sequel news, we had Bridget Jones's Baby.
Yes.
The third. I did not see the second one, and I have only the sketchiest memories of the first one. I read the first book.
I've never read any of the books. I've seen the movies. Bridget Jones is a young... media person
mm-hmm.
in London.
A singleton.
Drinks a little too much. Is always trying to lose weight. Although, as portrayed by Renee Zellweger in the first two films, just has a regular body.
Yeah, like when in 2001 when the first one came out, you would think that Renee Zellweger was Robert De Niro in Raging Bull.
Well,
The articles about, oh my God.
They talked about it like it was Shallow Hal.
Oh my God, she's putting in so much weight.
Right.
And then you see her like, oh, so you look like a run-of-the-mill human being now and not
right.
a movie star.
Right.
And how so, brave.
And so, completely charming. As that character, and the films are the same way. She's, you know, adorable. And that is how I've always seen.
She's likable. I can't stop thinking of her not being British. Like, I never...
Well, okay.
I never crossed that gap.
The accent she does is the kind where...
It's a little labored.
It sounds like... A lady's going to read you a story now. Like, that's sort of
That's sort of how her accent is. It's fine. You know, I don't mind it.
I think there is an entire generation.
I don't trip over it.
There's an entire generation of British comic actresses that are like,
well, you know what? They should have been around 15 years ago when the first movie came out.
No, I'm saying that's the generation I'm talking about.
Yeah.
The ones that were there, that were the right age for it, like, oh, finally, like, a British novel about a Londoner, a London woman, has become this global phenomenon, and they're making a movie, and oh, my big brain, oh, they can't, really? 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 Renee Zellweger? Well, good for her.
So, be that as it may.
Yes,
I'm a fan. I like Renee Zellweger. I've always liked Renee Zellweger, and I like her in this character.
She's fine.
I like her as this character, and in spite of the fact that this film is not funny,
every so often
I found it to be.
I chuckled.
Very pleasant.
It is. It is very nice and pleasant and enjoyable. It's not all that funny. I laughed a handful of times, and as I told you afterwards, I'm sure those were all lines written by Emma Thompson.
Emma Thompson just wrote her own lines.
Well, that
and
too.
No one else.
But she's credited on the screenplay.
I know. Well, you know, that's because she wrote some lines.
Right, but I'm just saying, I'm sure
the ones that came out of her character's mouth.
Yes, but I think she maybe wrote some other ones as well. But they definitely brought her in to juice things up. Yeah, it's just
It is a film. Well, here's what it's about. She goes to
a music festival
where clearly they couldn't get the rights to say the words
Glastonbury
or Reading
or you know, Bonnaroo or that's somewhere else.
No, Bonnaroo is here in the United States. Yeah, my friend Anthony, he just worked at Creamfields, which is a big electronic music festival. So they couldn't get the name of anything. They
just, Eel Pie Island.
Right, yeah. And you know, the humor, she meets Patrick Dempsey there. He's a billionaire
web
something.
Web tech billionaire. Guy. He has an eHarmony type site.
Yeah.
He thinks you can logarithm's a word. He thinks you can algorithm love.
And he... They have sex.
They shag.
And then, like, 2 weeks later, she has sex with...
A week later.
She has sex with, what's his face?
With Colin Firth.
And now she's pregnant. And she doesn't want to get the amnio because she's scared of the needle, so she makes them sort of fight over her for the next seven months.
Yeah, like, at first she doesn't tell either of them about the other one, and then finally she has to sort of fess up when they all show up at the thing and wacky hijinks, you know, and she's like, well, I don't really know who it is, and so... You know, then they go to Lamaze where the two guys wind up having to pretend to be a gay couple and she's the surrogate, yuck, 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 and stuff like that.
Funny because they're gay. Yeah. The film, when it is trying to be funny, falls flat on its face.
Yeah.
Because the jokes feel 10 years old.
Yeah, and it's a waste of really funny people who are in it because you've got like Shirley Henderson and Celia Imrie, but they just kind of pop up and don't get anything particularly juicy to do or say. And so it's a lot of Renee Zellweger falling
into mud. There's a lot of anti, you know, we hate these millennials sort of.
Oh yeah, genre. Yeah. They're like these new people at the TV news show that she produces. You know, it's like it's a crew of dudes with man buns and little twisty mustaches and ironic beards, and you know they're sort of like, you know, hard as nails, red lipstick boss.
Right.
She's actually kind of funny.
She's kind of funny. You know, they run into Ed Sheeran and they don't know who he is. And come on, you have to live in a cave.
Yeah, you can't. You work in the British media.
If you're in the British media and you don't know the face of Ed Sheeran, you're terrible at your job.
That the one thing I like about this movie is that, you know, it's always so adorable when Bridget screws up, you know.
Right.
And then later in the film, spoiler, like, she gets fired. And at first you think they're gonna raise a ruckus. And then they list out all the things she did wrong. She's kind of like, yeah, it's a fair cop, you know.
And so the film is at its best. And this is what I said on KCRW this weekend. The film is at its best when it briefly touches on issues of aging and loneliness.
Yeah, they keep referring to her as a geriatric mother because she's 43.
And things that are, you know, the story of your choices. And so she's 43 years old, and she's not married, and she has no children.
And she really should get the amnio.
And she's chosen all of these things. The movie doesn't really explore it too much, but when the movie is given a moment to breathe,
mm-hmm.
and she is given a moment to reflect a little bit on her life, that's when it feels the most real. And she's so appealing as this character, you simply want good things to happen for her.
As I was watching it, and not just because I was in a theater where I was, I think, the only dude, I was thinking that this is kind of like the British Sex and the City, only mm-hmm. instead of an ensemble, it's just this one character
right.
that all these things happen to.
Yeah.
But it has that same kind of appeal of, hey, I don't hear these voices or see these stories all that often.
Yeah.
And so I at least feel like I'm getting a glimpse into something that's not being shared all that frequently.
Right. So it's not great, but it's also not awful.
No, not at all.
And I am charmed by her. And if this brings on another Bridget Jones movie, okay, sure, fine. I'll watch another one.
I can't imagine where they would go.
Bridget Jones turns 50.
Yeah.
7 years from now, we get another one. I'm interested. I'll watch it.
If like Dave White, you are the kind of person who, when you are not feeling well, you like to be on the couch under a blanket and watching whatever Sandra Bullock movie can be found on any of the 7 HBOs that you have, I would totally put this movie on that list of a movie to watch when you are not feeling well and like under a blanket and need some cocoa.
It's The Lake House.
Yes.
That's really the only movie you need when you're sick is The Lake House.
Or Practical Magic.
The Lake House. Practical Magic was my jam for a while.
Now it's Lake House.
Until The Lake House came along.
Gotcha.
It's the only film like it. There's no film like The Lake House. It is by itself. It is a class unto itself.
You may have cinema. Ghost wife, but you don't have magical time travel mailbox.
Yeah. There are plenty of ghost wives in the world.
Yes.
There's only one time travel mailbox.
Yes.
And you did not.
Mm-hmm.
I saw Hillsong.
Yes.
Let Hope Rise.
It's interesting that people... we always get feedback from listeners about that they love to hear you talk about Christian movies. And I hope that it's not just they like to hear you dump on Christian movies, because you don't always.
I do not.
I think you're very fair.
I am.
And I think you dump on them when they deserve dumping on.
When they deserve it.
But you are willing to call a decent Christian movie a decent Christian movie.
This is a decent Christian movie.
Yeah.
Possibly because no one had to write it.
It's a documentary.
It is a concert. It is a concert film slash documentary. Title card comes up before the movie that says this film is intended as a musical worship experience. We invite audience participation. So, as you said,
oh, like the Oogie Loves,
exactly like the Oogie Loves. And I will tell you a thing. I went to the premiere of this movie, and when I say that I went to the premiere of this movie in Westwood at the Village Theater.
You sat near David A.R. White, Pure Flicks fame.
I sure did. I sat near everybody associated with the movie. They had me down in the front center part of the theater.
Yeah, how many L.A. press people do you think said yes to that invitation?
I did not see anyone that I knew in the theater. Not one single person.
Yeah, and all the I've seen one LA Times review.
There are only 5 reviews on Rotten Tomatoes for this movie. The press is ignoring this movie.
Yeah.
Which is fine. I mean, because it's not a contribution to film in any significant way.
Or the mass culture.
But because it's because its subject matter is interesting. And it's interesting to me, even if I had not grown up evangelical, it would still be of interest to me because they are a phenomenon. This band is a phenomenon.
Ba-pee-ba-dee-dee.
But first I want to talk a little about the premiere, and then I'll talk about the movie.
Sure.
I sat next to the band.
I sat across from, as you mentioned, David A.R. White, who was one of the Pure Flix bigwigs and who was one of the stars and producers of God's Not Dead.
One and two.
And
will be the star of three.
Just honestly, you've probably heard me talk about God's Not Dead before, but what a toxic sludge heap of a film.
Franchise.
I cannot say that enough times. Grotesque and offensive on every level. And I include filmmaking abilities in that discussion. The interesting part of this, T.D. Jakes was there.
No.
I was thinking as I was walking up the red carpet, like they had me, I had to walk up the red carpet. I was thinking as I walk up the red carpet, ooh, what Christian celebrities will be here? I didn't see any.
Alexa Panavega, whatever her name she's going by now, Alexa Vega from the Spy Kids movies, was there. Right?
Oh, was she?
I saw it on Twitter, yeah.
Okay, great.
Super pregnant.
I was just looking for Stephen Curtis Chapman. But I don't know that I would know him if I ran into him. Mm. I don't know his face well enough.
He
came along after me.
Was the Elvis impersonator from The Identical there?
No, not that I could see.
Bummer.
Stephen Curtis Chapman didn't come along in the Christian music world until long after I was out of that world. You know, I'm like, the thing is, a lot of them live in Nashville.
And so
you don't, you know. I was looking for Amy Grant. I didn't see no Amy Grant. You'd think they'd get Amy Grant to come to the premiere of this.
Sure they asked.
They probably did. So at one point in the film, the audience did participate.
Well, yeah.
Now here's, I'll explain.
You saw it with the band.
Explain a little bit about what I'm talking about. Hillsong is a church. It's based in Australia.
Right.
It is a Pentecostal church, I think maybe officially associated with the Assemblies of God, I think.
Okay.
And they are gigantic. They are as mega a mega church as you can get. They started in 1983. They have grown and grown and grown and grown, and now they are the new model of evangelical church, the franchise church, the branded church. There is a branch church of Hillsong in pretty much every major city in the world. There's one in Los Angeles, there's one in New York, there's one in London, there's one in Tokyo, there's one, you name a place, there's a Hillsong church.
It is the Denny's of religion.
Yeah. And that's the new thing, mega churches sort of expanding their reach via sort of satellite posts. You can attend Hillsong online if you would like. You can listen in your own language. They have people translating the services into all kinds of languages.
Urdu.
I do not know, but maybe. The band associated with Hillsong Church is called Hillsong United.
Right.
And the film is about Hillsong United. It's not really about the church itself. They touch on the church itself. They touch on the origin of the band. They touch on Brian Houston, who is the leader of Hillsong. His son, Joel Houston, is sort of the, I guess you could call him the leader of Hillsong United. He writes most of the songs, but they collaborate as a band. There's like 12 people in the band. So they're, you know, the Pogues, Soul to Soul, Polyphonic Spree. You know, Mumford and Sons. You know, those bands that there's like 14 people on stage.
How do they make any money?
Arcade Fire. That's always what I think. Who gets, how much money do they make? There's too many people.
Well, except for these folks.
Yeah, they're all employees / volunteers of the church. And so they don't necessarily make big salaries. And that is discussed in the film. They're not rock stars in the traditional sense, even though they sell out stadiums and arenas and whatever everywhere they go. They sell out the Forum and Radio City Music Hall and the O2 Arena and Red Rocks. Wherever they go, the audience is packing the house. They do what's known as praise music, which is different from what you might think of as
contemporary
Christian music. Amy Grant does not do praise music.
Right.
And she sings songs about life. And isn't it great that Jesus is here to help me with my life?
Mm.
That's basically the Amy Grant aesthetic. And I know I'm referencing Amy Grant, even though she's like from 30 years ago, because that's when I was
that
around.
That was your moment.
That was when I was around. Praise music is prayer in a way. Group prayer that is sung. And it is often just designed for the purpose of praising God. Because that's part of the New Testament sort of command. Mm. You know, you become a Christian and then it's your duty in life is to praise God with your words and your deeds. And so this is how they do it with their words. They sing. And more than any sermon, a band like this is doing what evangelicals say they are all about, which is actual evangelism. They are bringing in people who would otherwise ignore a sermon because the music is powerful. It's big music. It's like, musically speaking, they are a Coldplay meets Sigur Rós sort of situation. It's loud, soft, you know.
And they remix now.
And then they did a whole EDM remix album, and they've got like 40 albums, and they have this long 9-minute song, which has become sort of the Christian music Stairway to Heaven, no pun intended. It's a song called Oceans that was number one on the Christian music charts for a solid consecutive 45 something weeks, and then was slipped down to like number three, and then went back up to number one for another 10. So something like over 50 non-consecutive weeks at number one on the Christian charts, been on the Christian charts for 2 full years without any crossover attempt at all. They cracked the Billboard Hot Singles chart, a 9-minute song.
Hmm.
And if you listen to it, you really will get what I'm talking about, the whole Sigur Rós Coldplay thing, because it's fairly bland, but it's moving, it's musically sort of insistent, and the length of it is really, really effective because it is the kind of song that never resolves. It builds and builds and builds and builds this unresolved tension. And the lyrics are repeated over and over again in a sort of prayer trance situation.
So it's the Earth, Wind, and Fire's September of liturgical music.
Yes. Yes. If September were a really long song that never stopped.
Right.
Because that's the brilliance of September as well, is that you never have to stop singing it.
Yeah.
It never resolves.
Yeah. It builds and builds and builds. Yeah. It doesn't get anywhere. Yeah.
And so, I listened. On Monday, I did not know a single thing about this band. And on Monday, I spent all day between other chores listening to their music and looking up their facts about them. Then on Tuesday, I saw the movie. And by Tuesday seeing the movie, I knew that song. I knew that Ocean's song. I was like, this song isn't bad. I mean, I'm never going to listen to it again after this movie's over. But this song's not bad. And they, most importantly, and here's where I think they really win, they aren't jerks. They seem genuinely kind and sincere and real. They don't feel to me like, because you get to behind the scenes stuff about their lives, you get the sense that they are a little overwhelmed and a little flabbergasted by what's going on around them, this enormous success. My favorite line, I talked about this on the radio, I talked about it in the review that I wrote for The Wrap. Go to The Wrap, read my review of this film. The guitarist guy, he goes, we're the most famous band you've never heard of.
My own neighbors have no idea what I do for a living. They don't know where I was last night. And where he was last night was selling out the O2 Arena. And that's crazy.
Well, I did a little Googling, and I immediately found this page of some guy saying, here's why I refuse to, like, do Hillsong songs in my church.
Yep.
And it turns out on the list was that they weren't, like, specifically anti-gay enough.
Right.
And I'm like, okay, right. Well, then I guess that's boo.
I have heard from some gays who have told me that they believe that Hillsong Church has been behind...
In Australia
has been behind some anti-gay marriage stuff. But when I Googled that, I couldn't find anything. Hmm. And I don't know what that means. And I don't know if it means that they believe that that the church is involved in a sub, you know, public level.
Uh-huh.
Or if I just am bad at doing research on the internet. I think I'm okay at doing research on the internet. And when asked about gay stuff, the church, as a church, remains fairly non-committal on the subject.
Hmm.
And as someone who grew up in this, I'll tell you that for them to even move that much of an inch in the direction of decency toward queer people...
Non-committal is a pride parade.
Non-committal is their pride parade. Like, that's a leap, and they're going at it very slowly, I understand. But seriously, that's a step. And you can't, you know, you can't deny that it is a step. I don't want anyone giving them any medals for it.
Right.
Because they don't deserve a medal for it. They deserve someone to say, hey, by the way, catch up.
Yeah. Do better.
Yeah. Do better by the people that you claim to be, loving. So, but again, this doesn't have anything to do with the band.
Right.
The band itself, they seem genuinely caring. And
but they are like the propaganda machine for the church, right? I mean,
if by propaganda you mean that they are representing the church in their name,
yeah,
okay, sure. But their lyrics are not propagandistic. Their lyrics are
right. But I'm just saying their very existence is like a promotional machine designed to steer people toward the church.
To bring you to Hillsong Church. Okay, sure, yeah. But I want to get back to the gay thing just for a minute. One
sure.
more moment.
Okay.
There's a scene in the film where Joel Houston is writing lyrics to a song, and he is consulting a book by Henri Nouwen. Now, Henri Nouwen is dead, but he was a French priest who was a philosopher and a writer and straight up gay. And that's interesting to me, that this man influences to whatever degree the lyrics that they write for these songs. Again, I think it is a step. The movie is tightly focused on the band. It's from Michael John Warren, who directed the Jay-Z documentary.
Right.
He is apparently an agnostic. I don't know what his religious beliefs are. But, you know, these folks step out of their box and they go out into the world and they look and they act just like everybody else. And I think that's interesting. I find them fascinating.
Right.
Do not send me songs by them. I've heard enough to know that it ain't exactly my thing.
Right. Not your jam.
Yeah, not my jam. But not a terrible movie. I'm surprised that it's not doing better this weekend at the box office. I thought it would be doing better.
Yeah, I mean, PureFlix usually knows how to open this to the people that want to see it.
And, yeah.
Maybe that it's a concert film is of less appeal if people have already seen them or they feel like they you know... Because I when I was looking it up on Rotten Tomatoes, other things came up that seemed like they were sort of like concert videos, like DVDs that have come out of their shows and stuff.
Yeah.
Like of specific shows, not a tour doc the way this is.
Right.
So maybe it just didn't seem like it was new or fresh enough that they needed to run out and see it or whatever.
Yeah.
All right. But it's been knocking around for a while. It has been, saw the trailer for this like a year ago.
Over a year ago.
Yeah, I think it was part of the Relativity bankruptcy that has been sort of in limbo.
All right, so we're running up on an hour and 45 minutes of running time on this podcast.
Hour 25.
By the time we're done with the J.T. Leroy documentaries.
And Miss Stevens.
And Miss Stevens, we will be. So we may be coming up on another All Letters episode, is what I'm trying to say, because we're not going to have time for it today.
Okay.
Let's get to Miss Stevens, and then we'll dig into the J.T. Leroy stuff.
Yeah. So Miss Stevens, a movie that I saw this year at South by Southwest. I was on the American Narrative Jury, and we gave Lily Rabe Best Actress. And seeing it again several months later, I'm very happy that we did that, because I think it's a really great performance. She plays Rachel Stevens, an English teacher who is assigned to take three kids on a weekend drama competition at some hotel in another city. And it's about how the weird sort of teacher-student relationship, especially for high school students when they're in their teenage years and having all of their issues, and how much do you let them in and how close to them do you allow yourself to become, and where's the line, and who establishes where it should be. And you know, of the three kids, there's one is played by this actor Timothy Chalamet, who's been in Love the Coopers and several and Interstellar, and he is, you know, quote unquote troubled but talented and smart, and obviously trying to reach out and make a connection with her, and she sort of allows it but is also sort of trying to keep the walls in place as well. She's dealing with the death of her mother. And it's just it's a really smart and funny film. I love the performances. As somebody who spent many of the weekends of his high school life at debate tournaments, I've never seen a movie that really captures that feeling of, like, you know, smart high school kids in a hotel for the weekend and, you know, interacting with other students and you know, being with teachers away from school and that kind of thing. I like this film a lot. It's the first film from a filmmaker named Julia Hart.
Yes. I like this quite a bit. It's sweet and it is smart. There is a spark of life to the filmmaking that I appreciated. It's not just, you know, I'm an indie director, so it doesn't really matter what I do with the camera. It has a visual sense to it. It reminded me a lot of my own 8 years as a middle school slash high school teacher, in that every bad decision that she made, the teacher made, I would sit on the couch and think, nope. Nope. Shouldn't ought to be doing that. Shouldn't have said yes to that. You're asking for it on that one. It is perhaps a little too based in the wish of how people would behave with one another, rather than the reality of how people might behave with one another, in that none of her bad decisions come back to bite her in the butt.
I suppose.
Because she makes more than a handful of them. And there's a reason why the scene where the kid calls her by her first name and she snaps back, "My name is Miss Stevens." There's a reason why that resonated the most with me, and that's because you've got to have that.
Yeah.
You, as a teacher, you must have that wall. And it sounds like it won't. That sounds like it's counterintuitive. It sounds like you should get as close to your kids as possible, and dig in and try to, you know, really affect their lives. But at the same time, you just can't, because number one, there are too many of them. You cannot devote personal attention to that many kids at once. Secondly, you lose yourself if you do. And third, in this world, you open yourself up to every kind of criticism, misunderstanding, and eventually lawsuit.
Right.
And so, like, when I was a teacher, it was Mr. White. And I wasn't really into your personal problems. I wanted you to show me how you
could deal with the information that I had to teach you, and were you learning it? And so the character in the film, the man, the male teacher that she runs into, played by Rob Hubel, he gives a little mini monologue halfway through and says, yeah, I just don't care. I care about being a good teacher. I care about teaching the kids. But as far as the kids, their lives go.
Their little lives.
Their silly little lives. That's what he said. I thought, no. And he said, I don't care. I don't participate in that. And when he said that, I thought, that's right. You can't. You've got a job to do. Your job is getting the knowledge to their brains as well as you possibly can. In the process, you should be as kind as you can possibly be while maintaining a sense of order in your environment with those kids and not inviting them into your hotel room to jump on the bed, which is what she does. And that is no.
Well,
no,
she doesn't exactly invite him in. He sort of barges, nonetheless.
He barges in. But you know what you can do? Stand by the door.
Right.
Don't follow him into the room. You stand by the door and you go, out! Out, or I'm calling security of the hotel. That's what you do.
Well, I think the movie finds...
No, I know.
The movie finds things in the gray areas.
The movie needs to go into that direction to be the film it wants to be. Yeah. But I'm talking about...
reality.
Had this been a documentary.
I know. Yes, Mr. Wiseman, I know.
Rabe. She's terrific.
She's extraordinary. And she is the daughter of Jill Clayburgh. And there are certain angles where you're
like...
Oh, is
she?
Yeah, where you're like...
I did not know that.
Yeah, of the playwright David Rabe and of Jill Clayburgh. And there are certain angles where you're like, oh, yeah, you are totally Jill Clayburgh's daughter. And has that same wonderful sense of, like, neurotic... perfection. Mm-hmm. I don't know. It's hard to describe.
Right.
But that like just so beautiful and so kind of messy inside, but interesting and intelligent, very, very intelligent. And you just want to find out more about what's going on in there. I think I'm so glad that we honored her. This is the time of year where I started thinking about LAFCA, you know, LA Film Critics and who am I going to vote for and stuff. And she's very much high on my list right now.
Shoo. There are now two documentaries in the world about the author J.T. and Leroy.
Right.
There's one playing in theaters right now.
Called Author, the J.T. Leroy Story.
It is from Jeff Furzig, who directed two other documentaries that I'm a big fan of. Half Japanese, The Band That Would Be King.
Mm-hmm.
And The Devil and Daniel Johnston,
mm-hmm.
which I think figures into this, but I'll get to why in a minute. There's also a film that is available to be seen right now on Apple TV,
on Amazon.
It's called The Cult of J.T. Leroy.
Oh, sorry, no, it wasn't on Amazon. It's on iTunes, though, yes.
Okay. The Cult of J.T. Leroy,
right,
and it's from Marjorie Sturm.
Yes, we screened it at Outfest a couple of years ago. And I'm really glad you got to see it, finally.
Well, On Friday afternoon, I went to the ArcLight and I bought a ticket to see Author.
Mm.
I left Author, drove through some fast food, ran over to the Wilshire screening room to a different documentary called The Lovers and the Despot, which I'll be reviewing
in a couple weeks.
This week or next week for you at the Wrap. And I was so wound up from both of those documentaries in a row that I came home. And it was 10 o'clock, and I was still not ready to go to sleep because I was all keyed up from having watched two movies. Plus, I had a Coke through the drive-thru. That's always a bad idea. And I immediately watched The Cult of J.T. Leroy because it was only 90 minutes. And I'm glad I watched both films on the same day because taken together, they feel like...
the whole story.
Two halves of the story.
I've been saying that for ages. I saw Author at Sundance this year, and I had seen Cult of J.T. Leroy, and we did it at Sundance or at Outfest a couple of years ago. And my thing was, I recommend this movie, but only if you've also seen The Cult of J.T. Leroy. Like, you really have to see both movies to get the whole story, because Author has the full participation of
Laura
Albert.
Yes, who is J.T. LeRoy.
Who is J.T. LeRoy, who passed herself off as J.T. LeRoy. And Cult began with her participation, and then eventually we're sort of booted from that.
Yeah.
And so it's a more outsider view and a more, I think it's a tougher journalistic view of the phenomenon, of the events that transpired,
maybe,
than Author is. So I think both films together, Author gives you that from the inside stuff and things that only Laura Albert could tell you. And I think Cult gives you the outsider asking harder questions.
Here's what happened to other people who encountered Laura Albert.
Yeah.
One is clear. One is authorized.
Yes.
And one is clearly not authorized. Right. One is good looking, the other is a budget situation. One is Albert's story, and the other is stories about Albert. And, okay, first things first. I believe that the work, the writing, the fiction of J.T. LeRoy / Laura Albert stands the test. I was a big fan of J.T. LeRoy. I read Sarah. I read The Heart is Deceitful Above All Things. I read Harold's End. I think all three of them are really good. Moving, such moving stories. I don't care that this was a literary hoax. In fact, I love literary hoaxes, and I think that that angle of it is kind of cool. If you hate J.T. LeRoy and Laura Albert, and then hang on, because I'm not done explaining all of my feelings about this. Because I, again, on principle, I love a good literary hoax. I love the subterfuge. I love the going around the outsideness of it. I love all of that kind of stuff.
I'm just thinking about the ones that I know of, though, seem to involve, like, people. Like people who are misled, and that's where
I'm getting. I'm getting. To
I know
that.
You're. I think about. I don't know if The Night Listener is about J.T. LeRoy or somebody else.
I don't know. It might be. It could be.
It could be.
Because it happened to Armistead Maupin,
uh-huh.
And he's never talked about who it was.
He's. I don't think he has. No.
It could have. I mean, Armistead Maupin,
and it's San Francisco. You
yeah.
Know.
It could very well have been, I don't know. But who did get involved was Dennis Cooper, Bruce Benderson, Brian Pera, a lot of queer authors, queer male authors, who had phone relationships with J.T. LeRoy, because J.T. LeRoy was a writer who was allegedly, according to the story, late teenage years, was raised by a truck stop prostitute mother, then abandoned by her, was gender nonconforming, and presented in terms of, you know, in terms of the phone relationships that he had with people, told people he was transgender. Sometimes boy, sometimes girl, very fluid, very back and forth. Told people that he was getting a sex change. Told people that he needed surgery to correct mutilated, you know,
anus
and genitalia because of years of teenage prostitution himself. All sorts of things. Now, when I say these things, I'm giving you information that is in The Cult of J.T. LeRoy and Author, because all of the information is not in both in films.
Right. Again, you really have to see both of these movies.
With the assistance of queer literary figures and agents in the literary world, got a book deal and published Sarah, and it was a phenomenon. And the reason it was a phenomenon is because it's a really good book. So J.T. LeRoy needed to be seen in public, and so Laura Albert's boyfriend / husband, I can't remember now if they were married.
Boyfriend, but they had a kid together.
They had a child together. Her boyfriend, Jeff Knoop,
had a sister named Savannah who would go out in public in an Andy Warhol-esque wig.
Big sunglasses.
Big sunglasses, occasionally a giant sun visor, and be the physical presence of J.T. LeRoy. And so for a few years that worked and became a shining star in the literary world, in the film world, in the fashion world, in the music world. All the celebrities wanted to be J.T. LeRoy's friend. All the celebrities started hanging out with Savannah Canoop. Meanwhile, Laura Albert was at home doing all the work.
Well, while also passing herself off as a British social worker known as Speedy, who was taking care of J.T. and she and...
Canoop had a band.
She and Canoop had a band. And also the part of the story was that Canoop, who is now with Speedy, had been a former lover of JT's.
Correct. So all these layers of identity and invention and fiction.
Yeah. And apparently, like, Laura Albert, in addition to being a talented writer, was a brilliant phone call person. Like,
well, she was a phone sex operator for a while.
Right.
And she could do the British accent. And then she could also do a sort of sing-song Southern dialect as well. So it all came crashing down because an investigative reporter...
Started asking questions.
The smoking gun was a picture of Savannah Canoop with no...
sunglasses.
No sunglasses, no wig. And... with an expression on her face that basically identically matched one that was in a photo of J.T. LeRoy.
Well, and also the fact that J.T. had supposedly come out of this, like, San Francisco hustler scene.
And no one knew him.
And no one knew him.
Right, right. So, again, I don't think it negates the work. But I also understand that a lot of people along the way were manipulated and used and lied to.
Therapists,
you know, authors, agents, publishers, Courtney Love.
Dennis Cooper.
Who, when Courtney Love found out, she said, who cares? We'll get you another book deal. Like, that was... honestly, that was kind of funny to me.
Well, yeah, and an author uses, because the thing, you know, not only was Laura Albert doing all, maintaining all these phone relationships as JT, she was recording them all.
Yes.
And so all these tape recordings were an author, which according to the New York Times, a lot of people on the other end of the phone did not know they were being recorded and are not happy about
Asia it. Asia Argento is apparently incensed at the moment.
Yeah, she's very pissed. But I mean, you know, Courtney Love talks about the fact that she's in the middle of snorting coke while they're on the phone.
Now, that's an author.
That's an author. That's an author. Yeah. Cult, that's the thing. Cult doesn't have this insider stuff from Laura Albert the way that author does. So again, both, got to see them both.
Yeah. I do not like the exploitation of queer homeless youth for the purposes of getting ahead.
Or being HIV positive.
Being
for that
HIV
matter.
Positive. That is deeply troubling.
Yeah. That was, and the HIV thing was a big part of the mopping was the, stuff.
Yes, yeah.
If so, JT is indeed the night listener person.
I feel like my love of the grift can only go so far.
Absolutely.
And the people who were caught up in the story without their... obviously, they consented to be caught up in the story, but they were... They were feeling empathy for a kid who seemed incredibly troubled and on the verge of
self-destruction. Yeah, the guy who talks about spending 6 hours on the phone on Thanksgiving with JT instead of with his family because he thought that he was talking JT out of, like, killing himself. That's beyond literary hoax. Yeah. That's a mess.
Yeah. Now, what's interesting to me about author, because Cult of J.T. LeRoy, they dig in hard on her. And all the things you don't see Dennis Cooper and Bruce Benderson saying in author, they're saying it in Cult.
Yeah.
That movie digs in real hard and gives her no slack at all.
Yeah, I mean, cult. The best that cult does is at least provide to show you where this all started, and talking about how, like, when she was a kid, how she would create these phone personas and talk to, like, pretend to be an exchange student, talk to, like, the cute boy in her class, and blah blah blah.
Yeah.
In Author, you really get the sense of this displaced personality, to the extent where, like, she would send her own sister out as her avatar to punk shows.
Yeah, yeah, because she was scared to go out into that world herself, yeah, because she didn't feel, and I think this is very telling, she didn't feel like she would be accepted because she didn't think that she looked right.
Yeah.
And that set the template, really, for doing the same thing in the literary world.
Mm-hmm.
And near the end, and if you're going to have any sympathy or empathy for Laura Albert and why she did the things she did, it comes near the end of Author, and I don't think it's spoiling anything to explain this, but she talks about her own emotional, physical, and sexual abuse as a child.
Right.
Which seems like it really did happen, you know, unless she's playing another game, but I don't think she is. You know, she was a fat kid, and her last name was Albert. Guess what they did to her at school?
Right.
Hey, hey, hey. And that's devastating for a little child.
Absolutely.
You know? And to know that you have an ability to write and to create these vivid, specific, terrifying worlds, but to not be part of that transgressive queer lit community. You're a heterosexual woman in her 30s with a kid, and
right,
and you're a big woman. And the fact is that you're not going to get a book deal.
Although by the time the JT phenomenon was happening, she was not big anymore.
No, no, no. She, like, was. She was. It happened during the time.
I mean, well,
she got the gastric whatever during the fame.
Okay. Because, yeah. I mean, because when you see Speedy, like in Cult,
yes,
she's pretty slender.
Yeah, they don't show you fat Laura Albert in The Cult.
No,
they don't. J.T. Leroy. They leave that out, which is why part of The Cult of J.T. Leroy is unbalanced.
Well, but here's the thing, though. They were, I think, if they didn't have access, how would they know about Laura's past?
I mean,
you know, I'm sure if she wasn't a... She was barely a public figure while JT was happening. She certainly wasn't one before.
Right.
So where would
they
even...
But she was everywhere.
Right.
Yeah.
But I'm saying...
She was all around.
But the footage that you see of her in Cult, she's already thin.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So I'm just saying, before that, where would they have even... Where would they find that information?
I don't know. Yeah. I don't know.
I mean, you're right. It's a less balanced portrayal, but I don't know that it's necessarily the thing they did on purpose just to screw with her or to make her be less sympathetic.
The narrative that she's working with right now is that she was operating under a sort of punk rock manipulation of the publishing world.
Mm-hmm.
And again, that's a really appealing story for me, because I think, yeah, do it. If you're locked out of the publishing world because of how you look and because you're not cool, do whatever it takes. Get that, get paid, get your work out into the world. Unfortunately, I believe that she's talented enough that she could have written work based on her own life, her actual own experience, and it might not have made her famous, and it might not have gotten her to be, it might not have gotten her a friendship with Winona Ryder.
Mm-hmm.
It might not have made her a household name, but her work would still be out there, and she would have people who loved her work as it stood on its own.
But would people have helped? Would people like Mary Gaitskell and Dennis Cooper have helped her?
No.
And, you know, like,
I doubt
probably
it.
Helped revise or edit or, you know, whatever.
I doubt it.
Advise her on her material.
Right.
But the other thing is, if Laura Albert is famous for anything right now, it is as the most unreliable narrator imaginable. So then to have a documentary where she's telling her own story, you're like, well, why? Like, I need a lot of footnotes, because otherwise, why should I believe a word that comes out of your mouth?
And that's why I think Jeff Fierzig is a good director for this film, because he has previously worked with Daniel Johnston on a documentary about Daniel Johnston. And Daniel Johnston He's kind of an unreliable narrator himself. He's
in a different way.
Has had mental health issues his entire life. And the therapist in The Cult of J.T. LeRoy, who is apparently still Laura Albert's therapist.
Apparently so.
If we are to believe The Cult of J.T. LeRoy.
Or as of 2 years ago.
Or as of 2 years ago, yeah. The therapist is like, look, no, this is just a troubled person. He was the most calm, level-headed person in either documentary.
Mm-hmm.
Saying, well, no, this is just a person
who... He seems to be giving a deposition or something.
This is a person who I'm just working with because I want to work with this person and she needs me to work with her.
Yeah.
I think that Feurzig's affinity for artists who are on the margins. So, and that's what Laura Albert is. She was on the margins. She became a mainstream success. And now she's back on the margins in a very real way.
Yeah.
She does readings and signs the J.T. LeRoy books as Laura Albert now.
Right.
But the audiences aren't, they're not huge, and Ben Foster's not, you know, tearing up introducing her.
Right. And I think, you know, yeah, I think obviously a lot of what sold the J.T. LeRoy books was the J.T. LeRoy life story that she also crafted.
Yeah.
But at the same time, it's like, yeah, I'm all for, like, you know, during the McCarthy era when communist screenwriters had to hire fronts to, like, get their stuff sold or whatever.
Yeah.
Yes. Do what you got to do. If the industry isn't open to your stuff, find the back door, find the thing. And I'm all for that. But you're right. But then you get into the... I'm pretending to have HIV, or I'm spending six hours a day pretending to be suicidal.
And that is definitely where it becomes...
That's where it becomes like...
unacceptable.
Yeah.
No, I know. And I know personal... I have personal friendships with people who were affected by her.
Right.
And so... knocking things... That was not a microphone that I just knocked. And so their stories... You know, I carry their stories... along in my opinion of this whole situation. It just didn't affect me.
Right.
I interviewed Laura Albert, J.T. LeRoy, 3 times on the phone over the course of the career. Once about Elephant, the movie that she wrote, co-wrote with Gus Van Sant.
Right.
Once about a coffee table book about...
The Timothy Greenfield Sanders book about porn stars.
Yeah. Where she had a story in there.
It was an essay, but yeah, it's a story.
It was an essay, but yeah, a fictional story. And then one other time, and I can't remember now what it was. But
JT did a piece for us at The Advocate where he interviewed these like trans cartoonists in San Francisco who were doing a comic book.
That's right. I remember that. Yeah. So anyway, my phone conversations with JT LeRoy were among the most unusual phone interviews that I've ever done. And I've talked to Yoko Ono, okay? So each one of them was really nice. So nice. Like, I can't impersonate the voice, but it was along the lines of, hey, Dave, good to talk to you again. Like, it was like that.
Mm.
And I just remember... What an interesting voice this person has, which I'm sure people think about me when they hear me on the other end of the phone.
My brother thinks you sound just like Neil deGrasse Tyson.
I don't know that I do sound like Neil deGrasse Tyson.
I don't know either, but whatever.
but the expression in Spanish that you taught me is muy persona.
Yeah.
A very gregarious, charming, lovely person.
Mm.
And each time, mind you, these interviews took place over the course of a few years. And so I didn't expect him to remember me on any level, but he did.
I imagine like Jacqueline Suzanne with her index cards for like every bookstore manager in America, like, asking about their kids or whatever.
I am of literally no consequence to J.T. LeRoy's career. His career is... already in the stratosphere by the time I'm talking to him.
Right.
You know, I have nothing to offer. I have no ability to help or to detract.
But I'm sure she cataloged every single person she talked to. probably still has the tapes of all those conversations.
I think I might too. Like, we have a box of little microcassettes. I would have to dig through all of them because I didn't write down.
And find something to play them on.
I didn't label them. No, we still have the microcassette.
We do, okay.
But they were really nice conversations. They weren't They weren't difficult. They weren't like the things you hear about in The Cult of J.T. Leroy. Mm-hmm. These like wild, you know, damaging conversations. None of that.
Well, those were for the inner circle.
Right. Yeah, yeah, yeah. I was just some guy interviewing him. Yeah. But it always would strike me as, how does he remember anything about me? And then I thought, taking notes, maybe, on, like, information? Because, and was very, very, very friendly. Like, hey, next time I come to Los Angeles, my band's playing, come down, let's hang out. And I would think to myself, okay, and I would say, okay, sure, yeah, maybe. And inside I would thinking, I go to bed at 9 o'clock. I just really.
That's not happening.
I go to bed so early. I get really sleepy. You seem nice. We're probably not going to hang out. Like, it's just. Plus, I don't want to, like, Billy Corgan's going to be there. I don't want to pretend to like Smashing Pumpkins.
And he apparently was always in on it.
Not always.
No, okay.
He knew about it close to the end, according to author. He knew about it close to the end, and so did the creator of Deadwood. And the guy who created
Milch. David Milch, yeah.
The creator of Deadwood, when he found out it was all going to break, he was like, he was kind of like Courtney Love. He was like, who cares? Let's get you another book deal. Yeah. Right. So everyone's wildly different reactions based on how close they were versus what they felt exploited by. And now what I really love is the whole, well, those books were no good. That's hilarious to me. Because there are so many people now who are saying, well, those books were never good anyway. And I'm like, oh, wait, you're the person who helped get the book deal. So... what? How is this work not good anymore?
But the thing is, there is literature that becomes a big deal as much for the backstory of how it got produced and distributed, whatever.
I think this is really good writing. Itself.
No, I'm not questioning that, but I'm just saying I can see where people would think that once you take away the true, like, oh, this miraculous story of this teen hustler who was sexually abused as a child and managed to find a voice and you know, once you take that away, then you're left with the work itself. And you say the work itself holds up. I've honestly never read that much of it, so I don't really have an opinion either way. But, you know, I can see where people would be like, well, you know, you take that away from it and it's just whatever.
Yeah. So anyway, I had phone conversations with... this person that wasn't actually a person. Well, in Laura Albert's words, J.T. Leroy is J.T. Leroy. Uh-huh. If you're watching author, there's a lot of back and forth, like describing J.T. Leroy as a different person, as a separate
like
person.
Like third person versus first person.
Who had their own agency and who did things however they wanted to do things. Uh-huh. And then describing him as, well, this is another part of me. And so that's really fascinating. Mm. The idea of having identities within yourself. And so I continue to be fascinated by this story. I continue to be interested in this story. And
what's really interesting about it is this may be the last of the pre-internet con jobs.
Right.
Because, I mean, the internet was happening by this point, but this is about phone calls. This is still pretty analog,
this whole
you know, fax machines. Yeah. Right. This is not about like email addresses and fake accounts or whatever. This is still.
You would really have to work double hard to pull this off now.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Because they even had to like create this corporate entity that the checks went to.
And that's where they got her on fraud.
Right.
Because the name was signed J.T. Leroy and there is no J.T. Leroy.
Right.
Yeah. So yeah, y'all watch these movies.
Yeah,
both authors. Watch them back to back
if you can.
Really
yeah.
interesting.
Author is currently in theaters, and The Cult of J.T. Leroy is on DVD and streaming on iTunes and Vudu, I think.
Yeah. All right, we're done.
All right. So yeah, our DVD picks this week are Once Were Warriors and The Cult of J.T. Leroy, and we'll be doing a lot of letters very soon. So
now we've got another pile up of letters,
and we're now hitting the 2-hour mark. Uh-huh. All right. Okay. So thanks for listening. Go do all the things I always tell you to do at the end of every show, and join our club. And there's a new. App that carries this show.
Another one?
Yes, you can stream us on Satchel. That's a thing.
What is that?
It's an app. It is an app that carries podcasts. So, yeah, go. You can listen to us on Satchel or on Stitcher or on Podbean or Google Play, you know, or, of course, subscribe at iTunes and leave us a nice review. Oh, shoot, we have a new review on iTunes. It was lovely, and I don't have it in front of me, but I'll read it next time. So y'all are great, and if you're already a member of the show, thank you. And if you aren't, go to patreon.com/linoleumknife and become one.
Our
club.
Yes.
All right, until next time.
Goodbye.